Welcome to today's edition of the Zohar. We're dealing with one of these passages that is actually the ways in which it Kabbalists understand it to contain many coded messages about the nature of the universe. And the reason that that will happen is because of the word Targum. The Torah here is interested in the, you may remember last time we were dealing with some Aramaic and whether a particular thing was said in Aramaic or not for the angels to understand, and we're going to get back into that. Of course, the Hebrew word for translation is Targum, particularly in Aramaic translation. I guess the hesitance in my voice is that, you know, it's always hard to know what was originally intended by the mystics of the Zohar, and whether some of the fancier things and more complex things that Kabbalists today say were in it are in fact in it. Although this passage, and one of the reasons I'm leaning a little heavier into it for this passage, is because this passage contains a lot of contextual clues which don't make sense on the surface. In other words, the jumps between, on the one hand, Shavuos night and the verse of Bereishit and these two demon figures we're about to encounter today and Aramaic translations. It's very hard to follow the plot of this passage. But if you know the secrets that the mystics want you to know, the plot of this passage becomes inevitable. And so that makes me think that it's at least a plausible explanation, especially as we know that the Zohar was a cryptic mystical text, which had a whole body of oral traditions associated with how to interpret it. That is the core of what it means. So we know that. So that's just something I wanted to say at the outset. So if it's okay with you, I want to permit us to discuss something that features heavily in the Zohar and in Kabbalah as a prequel to the text. Because I think explaining it in the text will be harder than just doing a dive into it for a moment. Is that okay? And this could broadly be considered the Nisira. The Nisira. Nisira means the disconnection. And it relates originally to an idea expressed in the Midrash that Adam and Eve were created as an androgynous, one androgynous being with two faces faced back to back. And the creation of Eve is about their coming, you know, into two bodies taken from Adam's rib and coming face to face. For Kabbalah, the Nisira is not just a historical event or a religiously historical event or whatever the right term is for an event that occurred in the Torah about Adam finding a helpmeet, but rather it's a description of the male and female energies, or the right and left energies, or the top and bottom energies of divine emanation coming to fully face each other, ultimately culminating in an act of intercourse or whatnot that will bring the divine flow fully down. And in its most ultimate in a daily manifestation, you know, sustains life, but in the most ultimate manifestation of it is the thing that brings the messianic redemption. So this Nisira becomes very important. And let's see here. I don't know if it's worth going to the whiteboard. Actually, it's worth going to the Sfirot chart. I don't need a whiteboard when we've got the Sfirot. Okay. New chair, Sfirot. Okay. Okay. So how does this Nisira happen? How does Eve come to manifest? Which is really a question of here, how Malchut comes to manifest or how the world comes into being. So the answer is there's Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet here. Yeah, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. And these six are sometimes called in the earlier Kabbalah the Vav Ktzavot, the six branches, or, and we see it's represented by the letter Vav, right? But sometimes in Lurianic Kabbalah, they're called Zeir Ampim. They have a kind of personality called the short face of God, Zeir Ampim. And in order to extract, a new divine personality out of Zeir Ampin, in other words, in order to actually emanate, right? This is, if you're trying to place this, this is like the mechanical physics of divine emanation, if you just kind of get that there. So this thing, Zeir Ampin, has to have a divine withdrawal. In other words, in order to limit Zeir Ampin, if that makes sense, and to limit the level of divine presence present already at that level, God needs to withdraw. So how does that withdrawal occur? So it occurs through anesthesia, of course, the same way any operation occurs to cause you to lose your sensibility. And so, which is what happened to Adam. God put him into a tardema, an anesthesia. So in these terms, what that means is that Bina, or Chochmah through Bina, ceases its flow into Zeir Ampin for a moment, and this partsuf, this face, Zeir Ampin, is isolated. Without its intellect, it's effectively anesthetized. And for Kabbalists, that's what they mean by the tardema. They actually use the term tardema, which means, I think, something like anesthesia. It doesn't mean sleep. It means a very deep sleep that you would operate on someone in that state. Bina removes it so that this is isolated in order to have Zeir Ampin, here kind of conceived of as Adam, put into a sleep. And when Adam is asleep, there are two things that happen. First, the upper parts, Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, separate from the back of Zeir Ampin and begin to turn and become their own personality. But at that moment, they're separated, but they're back to back, as it were. And this upper personality, Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, separated from Adam, as an independent entity that's now been created. So Bina will return to Adam, but now there's another divine entity that's been created. That entity is called Lea in the Kabbalah. It's called Lea. Why is it called Lea? Because she's like the first wife who sneaks in, but then disappears a bit out of the plot. She's not the main idea. So she's like upper emanations, right? That's the Kabbalistic comparison. She's hidden. She's less revealed. She's not physically beautiful. So she's Lea. And then after Lea separates, Netzach, Hod, and Yesod separate and form another back-to-back personality. And that personality is Rachel, as you may have guessed, Rachel. And each of these entities then kind of combine into the feminine Malchut or Shechina. That's the sense of it. They become one, in a sense, they kind of merge and become Malchut. So this is a story that Rabbi Isaac Luria told to Chaim Vital. It's a remarkable sense he had. How did he know these things? I mean, he claims he's derived them from the Zohar. This is the Nesira. And ultimately, the meeting of Malchut, of this feminine energy, which is sometimes called Mayim Nukvin, feminine waters, abbreviated as Memnun in the Kabbalah, and the masculine energy, with Bina kind of restored, is like the ultimate tikkun. In Lurianic Kabbalah, there are two tikkunim, a tikkun Rachel and a tikkun Lea, to kind of fix or bring Rachel and Lea face to face, both with Jacob, as it were. Those are said at midnight, formerly known as Tikkun Chatzot. And if you've ever seen it in the Siddur, maybe you've seen it. It's in many Siddurim. And if you ever see the Tikkun Chatzot, that's why there's a Tikkun and a Tikkun Lea, a fix for Rachel and Lea. That's what they mean. They mean the feminine personality is taken from within Adam's rib, from within Zeir Ampin, in other words, and that come to manifest, but also cause problems. how do we know that the Zohar is talking about this here? Well, because the word targum, you may know, is the same as the gematria of tar de ma. And so when they're talking about, oh, it's the targum, it's the targum, what they're really talking about is the tar de ma of Bina leaving Zer Anpin behind and operating in this world where Rachel and Leah are not yet removed, but about to be. And that's kind of what's going on. So I just wanted to, I guess this thing, the Nisira of Rachel and Leah separating back to back and then coming to turn face to face, this story within the Godhead is a very important story for our passage. One other thing you'll need to know, and then we're going to jump into the text. We said before that Bina is sometimes called Elohim. And when we see mi bara ele, who created these, right? The act of questioning who or seeking to go beyond our own understanding to the infinite above is an act of reaching out to Bina here. And Bina is often symbolized by the word Elohim, which is mi and ele, Elohim, ele and yud mem, mi bara ele. So sometimes we talk about mi getting separated from ele, which means when me is separated from Ela, it's the same kind of state as the Tar de Ma. It's divine energy exists, but it's without the full flow of divine intellect. It's missing, it's missing the first three. It's missing that flow. So that's a kind of a state of being. And we said that Malchut is Ma. Malchut is Ma. So you may know that Tar de Ma, the word, is taken in Kabbalah to also mean tered ma, that ma falls. In other words, tarde ma is both a negative thing, right? It sounds like a negative thing. The divine energy is missing from the middle link, right? But actually, it's that state of with divine withdrawal that actually causes the tered of ma, that causes the shechinah to come into being, that causes divine presence to emanate. And so this kind of secret of mi and ele and ma and targum, the translators, which of course these are translators, they translate divine energy into a less beautiful human language, right? That's what's occurring here. Through a slumber of divinity, through the weakening of divine energy, is in fact what the whole Torah is about. And that's the Zohar's first claim immediately here. And now we're going to get to the text, which is that you think the Torah is an act of remarkable revelation, but actually we think that the Torah is an act of remarkable conception, because concealment, because the Torah is concealing, has to conceal divine beauty in order to be able to translate that into terms, and the Targum yet further. So all of that is today's rather cryptic introduction, but it's information that will, I hope, be useful. Okay. Questions before we move on?
I have one. Go on.
Okay, thanks, Andy. So this is Luria's interpretation. He's a lot later than the composition of this text, even if we believe the scholars that this is a late text to start with. Mm-hmm. So, nevertheless, we take this to be a quasi-authoritative interpretation of this part of the text.
Yeah, so I'm sharing Luria's interpretation of this text. Modern Kabbalists take Luria to be the authoritative Kabbalist. And so it's sort of like, right, modern Kabbalists do by doctrinal kind of point of view. I guess I'm not questioning that, but I don't always bring in the Lurianic interpretation. I rarely do. I'm doing it here because they're going to immediately start referencing Cain, a descendant of Adam. And we wonder why they're referencing Cain in this text. Like, what does Cain have to do with anything? They're going to immediately reference a Targum. What does a Targum have to do with anything? But Luria is the one that had good explanations, the only explanations for these passages that otherwise remain ununderstood. So it's kind of like, you know, because I read the mat a few times just to see if, like, could I tell a story that someone would understand based just on the footnotes that makes any sense? like you can read the words and understand what they mean, but could I summarize this teaching? And the answer is I could not. I couldn't make it into anything. So I just am using whatever there is. I don't know if that's helpful, but I see internal clues in the passage that suggest that also other even before Loria, and maybe this is why Loria is taken as kind of authoritative, right? Tardemon, Targum are seen as interchangeable. And some of these traditions, that there's a Nisira that's important, is understood. The Zohar mentions the Sodha Nisira, the secret of Nisira. These things are mentioned and referenced in the Zohar. It's just other Kabbalists struggle to explain them. And so they, it's not like a whole cloth invention or imposition. It's rather one take, but there probably were other similar takes.
Thank you.
Maybe. Okay. So knowing that, Andy, did you have a point?
No, it's not that important. So let's move forward. Thank you.
So I'm just going to read this beginning. Well, I'll read this beginning again. Psach Rabbi Shimon Ba'amar Breshis Bar Elohim Haikra Islis Dakla Bey Dechol Manda Amar Yisalach Ra Ish Tzei Me'almin Kimad Itmar Kidina Timrun Lahom Elaha Dishmaya V'arka Lo Avadu Ye'avadu Me'ara Umin Tchom Shmaya Ela Begin to lace Ella Achra Bar Kucha Brihu Bilachudi. Rabbi Shimon opened saying, oh, do you have what I have? You have the English?
Yes.
Rabbi Shimon opened saying, in the beginning, God created. This verse calls for contemplation. By the way, already that's like a hint. Right? Contemplation here already implies something deeper than interpretation. For anyone claiming, that there is another God, is extirpated from worlds, as it is said, thus shall you say to them, all right, I'll hold my comment. Thus shall you say to them, the gods who did not make heaven and earth shall perish from earth and from under these heavens. For there is no God other than the blessed Holy One alone. The first thing to know is that the contemplation referenced here, the verse calls for, it really is the clave to look at it. But the idea that the Zohar is referencing the calls for contemplation already conjures up the midah, the attribute of bina, right? Which is a contemplative midah. And so we know that bina is already at play in the kind of coded words of Rabbi Shimon. You have to look carefully at it. Okay, so that's the first piece. Now, the second thing is that the only word in this Aramaic verse in Jeremiah is Ela, is these. If you remember, I'm sorry, the only Hebrew word, it's an Aramaic verse, right, that says that there's only one God. And all the other gods are going to perish from under the heavens and the earth. Chos Shemaya Ela. So immediately the Zohar understands Ela to be Ela, Mi Bara Ela, right? Remember that teaching from early on? It's understanding this verse from Jeremiah in light of its teaching that Mi, Bina, who is God, created these, created Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Yesod, Mi Bara Ela. So when we're talking about, remember we said this was a Shemayim and this was a Shemayim. So when we're talking about mitchot Shemayim Eile, from under these heavens, we're saying, actually, and giving a definition of idolatry that's different than polytheism, we're giving a definition that says, or we're already hinting at a definition that says that when Eile, when these are missing me, when Ela is separated from me, when Elohim is broken up into two, and these are missing their upper energy, these take on a kind of idolatrous existence. And so when it talks about false gods, they're not fake. They're real in the Zohar's understanding of it, and they're demonic. And that's going to come, and you have to be with the Zohar on this kind of unstated link. Right, it hasn't said any of this. This is all just me saying things. But none of this is in the text, just to be clear. Just the word Ela. But it's really Loria that told us that the Zohar is implicitly noting that this is the realm where demons exist when me is separated from them. And so the state of Tardema, as it were, or Targum, which fits the language that Ela, these talk with amongst themselves, is also the state at which, you know, demons emerge, destructive energy. And so, this is also, therefore, this is also a description of how evil comes into being. Now, in other words, the Zohar is dealing with all of the monotheism problems right now. If there's one God, what about our multiplicity of angelic beings? If there's one God, where is evil in the world? If there's one God, how are we here? Where do we live? Is this all fake? It's dealing with all the problems in one kind of interpretive moment. Meets Chod Shemaya Eila. Okay. And moving on. We did a little bit of that last time. Krayu Targum Bar Milisov Mimila Desov Kra. So, okay. Itema begin de malachin kadishin lanes gakim le targum, veloish de modan bay, mila daya oti le memar belishna kadisha begin de yishmu malachin kadishin, yonis kakin le odal da. Alevada begin kakativ targum, de la nizka kim bay malachav kadishin la yakanun bevarnash le avasha le begin de vahaikra bechlala, inun malachin kadishin, ta ha inun Elohim ikrun. Uvichlalad Elohim habu, v'nu lo avadu shemayev ve'arka, ve'arka ve'ara, ve'arka ve'ara mibayel. Okay, we'll pause here. That's the next. It's almost Talmudic. Okay. Now, this verse is in Aramaic, except for the word ending the verse. I just want to see the mat note here. Namely, the Hebrew word Ela, these. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Oh, stop scrolling. Now, that's important. The reason Ela needed to be singled out was to teach us this thing. But if you suppose, let's go to the pshat, plain meaning of the text. If you suppose that this is because the holy angels do not attend to Aramaic, which is our tradition, nor recognize it, then this word should have been spoken in the holy tongue so the holy angels would listen and be obliged to acknowledge it. But indeed, precisely because of this, it is written in Aramaic. For since holy angels do not attend to it, they will not become jealous of a human and harm him. For those holy angels are included in the verse, since they are called Elohim, gods. They're included in the category of gods, though they did not make heaven and earth. So this was a kind of choppy way to say what it's trying to say. But we're going through, well, maybe, Hava Amina, this was in Aramaic because the angels don't recognize Aramaic. But then the Zohar says, well, wouldn't you want the angels to hear this message? Because they're also, they're foreign gods that might revolt on high, as it were. You know, like, you need them to hear this idea that there's only one God. You don't need humans to hear it as much. We know we're mortal, don't we? But angels, who knows about the angels? So I would have thought it would be in Hebrew, says the Zohar. But no, it's actually written in Aramaic, because if they thought it was talking about them, they'd get upset and attack us. So it's written in Aramaic to protect us from the wrath of these angels, who would get upset at the accusation that they're trying to usurp the divine, that they need to hear the message. So it's written specifically in a language they don't need to hear. Now, normally angels, I'm just going to be honest, we don't attribute to them this, like, they do God's work. They do the message they're sent on. As soon as we acknowledge that they would become jealous of a human and harm him, we're breaking from the classic view of angels. I just want to note that. It's a little subtle. The classic view of angels, they don't start doing stuff on their own. But here, they have a fairly human characteristic, not unlike the gods of other mythologies, yes? And in fact, I think the Zohar is doing that intentionally to point out that angels are a threat, you know, to the divine system. And so it intentionally highlights or emphasizes possible flaw that we might otherwise ignore. Now, when it says the holy angels are included in the verse, since they're called Elohim, they're included in the category of gods that did not make heaven and earth. What we mean to say is that angels live in Bina, at least in this version of it, the holy angels, the ones being talked about here, because they live, it says they're also Elohim. And we said that this is the name Elohim because it contains me. And so angels are up in this Bina realm. And so they can't understand Aramaic. Aramaic is a language which is down here. This is the realm of Hebrew, and this is the realm of Aramaic. This is a kind of new teaching today, new Kabbalistic teaching. Hebrew is a divine language, Lashon HaKodesh, from Bina, with full embodiment of the divine messages inherent. Whereas Aramaic sounds a lot like Hebrew, but it's a much more limited manifestation of the divine, such that angels can't understand Aramaic because they live above that world. We can understand it all. Okay. We good to this point? The Arka and Earth. Now, I think it's here. I guess I want to say another word about this. There's an idea that Ma and me, there's a yichud, a unification that occurs, and that our job is to kind of lift the Ma and turn it into me, or to, and that's called feminine waters because it's Malchut, to kind of send water rising upward to serve as a conduit for divine flow downward. There's this idea that divine energy needs a liquid medium, and that's why it's called Mayim Nukvim, feminine waters, and we have to do that. And that actually can be seen in the words Ma and me. So if you have me and Ma, what's the difference between me and Ma? And they're both question words, but like letter-wise, what's the difference?
Yud-hey.
Yud-hey. So they understand it kind of like this. If you take yud, that's yud, I drew a block letter yud, right? And you would spell yud, that is emanated. I'm not really a block letter person, but whatever. What do you get? Well, you could take the second letters, Dalet and Vav, and form a Hey. You see that magic trick I did there? Everyone see, we took Dalet and Vav, put the Vav there, made it a Hey. You see how we did that? So the idea is, it's a little better because the word do in Aramaic is to. right, the word Dalit and Vav forms is too, which references the two parts of Fim, the two faces, as it were. You know, that there's Adam in the front, but there's a feminine face in the back. And so the idea is that Ma and me, the Ma is in the me, as it were. This is part of the kind of theory of emanation as opposed to creation. They understand it even in these, this is a letter representation of a concept, right? So I guess what this is meant to convey is the sense that through Ela, right, through the Vav, right, we're kind of creating a bridge between the Ma and the Mi, such that even in Binah, later emanation is already present, and even in later explicated emanation, hey, there's already the upper energy is present. You know, this is just the Yud spelled out. What we see here is divine energy spelled out a bit more. So this, becomes important. I guess the final thing I want to say is that Ma is the divine name for the lowest level. There are kind of four divine names in the Kabbalah. There's like Yud, Hey. Well, we'll skip that for now. That's not relevant for now. Skip this.
Rabbi, this last little gloss, this isn't here in our text. So this is who speaking? Is this your observation or this is Luria or some commentator?
Yeah, this is what, you know, Ramak taught this already. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero taught this.
Okay.
Maybe the earliest source I saw it was Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. Luria taught this as well. And Rabbi Moshe Cordovero taught this in the Pardes Rimonim for looking for a site.
And are they teaching it with respect to this passage that we're looking at in the Zohar? They see this passage with this word Ela and then yeah, they're adding this extra glass.
This passage is reflecting this idea. Okay. And the idea is, let me quote it actually in a way that it's quoted in one of the, in the Sulam, who's like a summary of earlier Kabbalistic ideas. He says like this, is it okay if I read one?
Yeah.
The entire repair of the world is dependent on the connection of Ela and me through feminine waters. This fix is called Hebrew, the holy language, the Shona Kodesh. The Shona Mosnaim Machriya Be'emza, the language of the scales that weigh in the middle. Through it, we find that the continuity of the mind that is called holy, the mochin, meaning bina here, and chochma, which are called kodesh. So this causes the holiness from above to flow through Tiferet, as it were, and Shechina, umachria atvan ela lekavschut de kedusha, and it brings ela, the middle ela, towards holiness. Okay, now ule umat yesh lashon targum. There's also a targum. Ki beitche enatach toni ma'alin ma'inukvim betahara. When lower beings don't elevate the feminine waters in purity, meaning they sin. Then their actions only adhere to Ela, to the part of the Godhead represented in the middle. And they don't relate to me, Bina. So then we get Ma. So we have a targum, which is a tardema asleep. So that's like I said before, actually, that it's the letters of descending ma. Our actions are not in purity. As mit galima achorim shasfirot, and then the backside of the spherot is revealed. Tered ma, benimza yordima mosdaim uvaim lekaf chova, and we find that will be judged for guilt negatively. So that's a classic quote from a Laureanic commentary on this very passage. Yes, I realize we've gone far afield from the text itself, but which is one of the critiques of those sorts of things, which Matt is an antidote to, right? It's in the text, not in this. But here, the Targum and the Tardeman Elan Lemir are essential to the teaching. Okay, so all that is a little fuzzy background, but I'm going to return us to the text. Is that okay? Let's see where we go. Where were we? Shemayava Arka. So here you do need to know that there are seven Svirot, and it's understood that there are also, when those seven Svirot have their backs acting, as it were, this is a way of saying like their dark side, or not with their intellect, not with Bina to balance them out, but they are asserting for themselves. This is a kind of theory of idolatry, right? Divinity without order. But the theory of idolatry here is that the divine beings are lacking the substructure to have a deity in charge at the top who transcends ego. Bina is me, who, which goes beyond the self. So these divine energies are caught up in themselves and their own power. That's the kind of theory here. And then when they are doing that, acting in a tardema, or using the language of Aramaic, and not having holiness, but rather having darkness. So then what happens is the seven earthly realms descend into Shekhinah. The seven spirit manifest in Shekhinah, the energy comes down, and they form seven earths, not seven heavens. Seven heavens are above, but now we have seven earths. And what are they? I wrote down a list. Okay. Eretz, Adama, Arka, Gia, Nesa, Tzia, and Tevel. Tevel is the most elevated of all of those, and Arka is the third from the bottom. Okay, so now let's go to that. So the Gemara, the Zohar says the Arka, the Arami Baile, Ela Begin the Arka I Chatem Inun Shva Rindilatata, Behu Atar Ich Bini Benoi De Kayin. So it says we'll destroy all the gods from under the Arka. And the Zohar says, and Va'arka and earth, the verse should read Va'ara, the normal word for earth. But Arka is one of the, I'm going to add, jargony seven earths below. Site of the descendants of Cain. After he was banished from the face of the earth, he descended there, generating offspring. He blundered there, knowing nothing. It is a dual earth, dualized by darkness and light. Two officials rule there, one ruling darkness, the other light, inciting one another. The tradition about Cain is a pretty radical one. The idea is that Cain, and this is referenced in other parts of the Zohar, the idea is that the snake inserted its venom into Eve, but this is a new thing, and that Cain is a part a product of Adam and Eve, but in part a descendant of the snake, and that the negative energy is represented by the venom of the snake, which mixed with Adam's semen, right? That's the idea. Or in Kabbalistic terms, before the Nisirah, which I mentioned before, was complete, it was supposed to occur in order to create people, but before that fully happened, this procreation already started. So Cain represents a level of old soulness in a negative way that is from before the completion of the divine energy of creation, only from Ela. Cain is considered to be from the state of Adam, almost as if in the Tardema, so to speak, like the divine Mochin weren't fully functioning. And so Cain has a level of evil about him. This dual earth that we're talking about, ruled by darkness and light, the sense of it is that the divine energies rule without any boundaries, right? It's just a constant competition in battle. And that it represents very much, I think, for them, the world they see in a certain way, like the actual world. Okay. There's probably a lot more to say about Zoroastrianism and other things in this context, but I'm just going to keep reading this teaching. Be'it taman train memanan shalitin di shaltin da b'chashocha v'davin ahura. Be'tamin kachoga da b'da b'shata denachis l'taman kayin. Ish detafu da b'da v'ish delimu kechada. Be'kol achazit inun toldot te kayin. Yada inun betrain reishin ketrain chevan. Bar dechada hu na'ora shalit natzach dilei b'natzach alachra. Yaldait kalilu di vachashocha bin ahora vavuchad inun train memanin af. Okay, so real Kabbalists wouldn't even say these names, but I'm not really a Kabbalist. I'm teaching the Zohar. I don't know. We'll say them, I guess. Afrira vikastimun vidiukna de lahunka diukna de malachim kadishin beshit gadfin chad diukna ketorava chad diukna kinishrava chad mitchabran itavidu diukna da adam.
This is a reference to the chariot.
Yeah, it is. It is. So we said that there's darkness and light. And just to be clear, why is all this happening? All this is happening because there's emanation happening without Bina involved. Or there's emanation happening in response to our ascending of Mayim Nukvim, not in Tahara. Our religious actions that are not done in purity. That could be just sinful action, or it could be mystical actions done in the wrong way. So when people sometimes say, you know, don't mess with the Kabbalah until you're 40 and married and have a beard and all that stuff, because it's dangerous. And you're like, well, what do we mean? And so most people think what they mean is something like theologically dangerous. You might become, I don't know, a polytheist or even polyamorous, or who knows what might happen if you read this stuff, right? So, but what the Kabbalists meant by dangerous was not that you might, you know, not understand and go off on the wrong course. What they meant is that you might try and ascend from Shechina, but be doing it all wrong and be empowering the dark side and not the light side, like Cain. Now,
Is Cain empowering the dark side here? He's stumbling down into these regions, but the light side, they're bound together, the dark and the light, but the one of light rules. Did we get to that part of the English yet?
We're about to get there. Okay.
Okay.
So two officials rule there, one ruling darkness, the other light, inciting one another. When Cain descended there, they joined... did we get here... where did we leave off? I don't know where we left off. But He blundered there, knowing nothing. It is the dual earth, dualized by darkness and light. Two officials rule there, one ruling darkness, the other light, inciting one another. When Cain descended there, they joined together, were completed as one, entirely befitting the offspring of Cain. So they have two heads, like two snakes, but the one of light rules, prevailing, defeating the other. So those of darkness merged in those of light, and they became one. Those two officials are Afrira and Kastimon, who resemble six-winged holy angels. One resembles... What happened here? Oh. One resembles an ox, the other an eagle. When they join, they are transformed into the image of a human being. So here it's worth noting, just at a very basic reference point, the image from the very first chapter of Ezekiel, where he sees a divine chariot with four faces. And it might be worth just reading that for a moment, if that's okay. Okay, so we have it right in the 30th year on the fifth day of the fourth month in the exile that Ezekiel sees Marot Elohim, visions of God, famously. The only kind of ones not in Israel, notably. Okay, va'era v'hine ruach sara ba minat zafon anan gadol ve'esh mitlakachat v'nogalo saviv u'mitocha ke'en ha'chashma mitocha esh. I looked, and lo, a stormy wind came sweeping out of the north, a huge cloud and flashing fire, surrounded by a radiance, and in the center of it, the center of a fire, a gleam as of amber. And it's this description which apparently has led the History Channel to constantly run specials claiming that aliens invaded during the time of Ezekiel, and they just play it all night long for some reason. Umi tocha demus arba chayos v'zeh marean demus adam lahina. In the center of it were also the figure of four creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the figures of human beings. So arba panim la'achas v'arba knafayim la'achas lahem. However, each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. So there are four creatures with four faces and four wings. If you can follow that. Viragleyam regel yeshara. And their legs were fused into a single rigid leg, the source of our custom to stand with feet together during the Amida and Kedusha and whatnot. V'kaf raglayam k'chaf regel egel v'not zitzim k'in nechushet kalal. Right, and the feet of each were like a single capsule, and their sparkle was lost of burnished bronze. Okay. I'm going to just skip down to the, here we go. Udmut pnehem, and their faces were pnei adam ufnei aryeh leyamin la'arbatam ufnei shor me'asmol la'arbatan ufnei nesher la'arbatan ufnei v'chamfem prudot milamal li'ishtayim chovrot ish ushtayim nechasot et kviyote tehina. Each of them had a human face at the front. Each of them had the face of a lion on the right, the face of an ox on the left, and the face of an eagle at the back. So we have human, lion, ox, and eagle. And it's, yeah. Okay, and such were their faces, as for their wings, and then it goes into this description. So this is what Joe is referencing, I believe, is referencing this passage, which is clearly being referenced in the Zohar. Okay, I just felt it was useful for us to have that.
It's another big Rambam touchstone too, in the beginning of Mishnah Torah, which is, I'm reading like the Moshe Edel book right now, and which is kind of interesting to be like what comes when and in what order. So interesting to come across the reference here. So I guess it makes all the sense in the world that this would make its way into Zohar.
Hmm. You're reading that new book.
Yeah, the Midot, which is, I guess the comment just I was going to wait to make here is because he's, I don't know if you've read it yet. I saw you
it's on my reading list, but I've not read it yet, yeah.
So he's, to the extent I'm understanding it at all, he makes a big deal about the idea that the Zohar goes with the principal Midot of essentially kind of the tetragrammaton versus the Elohim, and mm-hmm. kind of how that combination is, it's all about it. And basically that's kind of like becomes like the central idea of Zohar, and kind of the big idea that you can trace back to like basically Gemara era readings. Maybe that's like the germ of where Kabbalah comes from, again, to the extent that I'm understanding what he's saying. So but it's interesting with this reading, because it seems to be saying this is this other world where darkness and light are not separated, where you don't have like the midot kind of separation. You have kind of, it looks like this mixture, and the mixture is creating this chaos, I guess, or this kind of, you know, this sort of unpleasantness. So I don't know if that's what's going on here, but it's interesting. So I'm like, was this an alternate reality where the midot don't get established, or they in the same way as they do in sort of our existential world? Mm.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I don't know that I shared it correctly or well, though, so nobody take any of that to heart.
So next time, I realize this was a little difficult, so I'm going to try and summarize this now. Next time, we're going to dive into these demons. The idea of two comes from the verse, Ki malachav yitzavelach v'shmorcha b'chol derachecha, which finds this idea that a person always has two angels accompanying them. Because it's plural, so it's at least two. And these two angels, one is good and one is bad, and they're in a battle. And the good one will always, if the good one wins, the bad one becomes good. And if the bad one wins, the good one becomes bad, is kind of the usual sense of the two angel stories in the Zohar. That's just like the general. And it even finds reference in, like, you know, the Midrashic tradition about two angels escorting you home from synagogue. Actually, the earliest versions of the Midrash have one of the angels being evil. But if they see the table set for Shabbat and the bed meeting, whatever, they're happy and they're both good and they bless you. And that's why we sing Shalom Aleichem. That's at least the kind of story. Next time, we're going to dive into these demons a little bit and connect it. So what did we do today? We described where we went to Bereshis Bara Elohim Es Hashamayim Ve'Haaretz, and we're immediately dealt with plurality, Elohim. In the beginning, gods created. And like, who created, we want to know. Is it many gods or one God? And the answer is, well, it's one God who's trying to destroy the many gods. And like, there are a lot of different figures involved here. There's the angels, and they're actually kind of good. And they don't create it on their own. And they're up in Elohim, and then there's the other forces, which when they're lacking input from divinity above it, when they're in a state of tardema, they speak in targum, and all kinds of dissent can happen. And when we perform actions below that either aren't proper or misguided, we may summon those forces, like Cain did, into this third of seven realms where certain things happen. And the tikkun is the opposite of this. This is coming after the tikkun because it's like the opposite of the tikkun, right, of Shavuos. Tikkun of Shavuos fixes all this. We're now kind of, by the by, delving into the Zohar's theory of the metaphysical ordering of the world we live in and inhabit, including its angels and demons. So does that work for folks? These are harder passages than we've done, I'm going to say, in a bit. But I think when you do like all of them and look back, you can kind of piece them together. So that's the instructor tip. It's like, you have to go through it. You have to work out just the plain meaning. Like, what is it saying? And what does that mean? Then you have to figure out what the like mystical meaning is. What does that mean? And the deeper, then you have to like recalibrate. Okay, what are we talking about? And what message does that give us? And then maybe we can kind of appreciate. Those are like the multiple steps I take to try and figure out what is going on in the Zohar. So we'll keep going with this teaching. Next time, demons. Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Happy Hanukkah. Thank you.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.